Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Happy Year of the Horse. Today on our program, what comes after the ceremonies to reform the NYPD? Bloomberg-style stop and frisk has nearly been abolished already. What other reforms will the federal monitor oversee after yesterday's federal lawsuit settlement? We'll talk to public advocate Letitia James about that and more in just a minute. Also today, this week in Bridgegate, Matt Katz from New Jersey Public Radio and WNYC's Andrea Bernstein review the progress of the official investigations and of their own investigative reporting. Plus, two State of the Union explainers. What did President Obama mean when he proposed equal pay for equal work? Isn't that already the law? And what's this new retirement plan he announced? Should you set up a MyRA? From the Brian Lehrer Show bookshelf today, economist Paul Oyer with his new book, Everything I Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating. And before the Super Bowl comes the Brian Lehrer Show Culture Bowl, a call in today for anyone from Denver or Seattle, in fact, anyone from Colorado or the state of Washington, to throw down on which is a better place to live. But my first guest is public advocate Letitia James, today completing her first month in office. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian, and hello to all of your listeners, and thank you for your support.
And you were one of the participants in the announcement yesterday of a settlement in the stop and frisk lawsuit. Here is the mayor for just a few seconds from that event.
With today's legal action, we put in place new policies that will create real lines of communication between police and community and ensure that policies are being carried out in a constitutional manner.
A constitutional manner because a federal judge had ruled stop and frisk unconstitutional as practiced. The de Blasio administration will now not appeal that ruling. But public advocate James, what will the agreement change since stops are already down by something like 80%?
I think stops are down primarily because they've received the message from the top. And that message is that stop and frisk obviously is a useful tool, but it should not be abused, and it should be based on – and stop should be based on objective criteria as opposed to race. And I think going forward, there's a menu of options that have been put forth by the judge. And clearly moving forward, once the federal judge indicates that the case can be remanded to district court, we could go forward and we can come up with a panoply of options to engage in stops that are both legally and not in violation of the human and constitutional rights of individuals who have been primarily, as was indicated yesterday, people of color.
A panoply of options, meaning there are decisions yet to be made.
Correct.
And here's another clip from the event, because it wasn't all smiles at the announcement. It was a lot of smiles between the plaintiffs and the mayor and you. But here is Vincent Warren, a plaintiff's lawyer in the case from the Center for Constitutional Rights.
This is where the real work begins. Nobody standing here is pretending this is mission accomplished. The problem has not been solved.
The problem has not been solved. Do you agree? Mission not accomplished.
No, not as of yet. And the work begins. We've got a lot of hard work ahead of us. But at least this is a step in the right direction. And at least all indications are that we have a mayor who currently understands the problems, a police commissioner who understands the problem and recognizes that you do not have to violate constitutional rights at the expense of safety in the city of New York.
And listeners, on the stop and frisk agreement or anything else, public access to the public advocate, 212-433-WNYC. Our lines are open if you have a question for Letitia James, 212-433-9692, or a tweet at Brian Lehrer or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And this agreement includes a federal monitor to oversee the NYPD for the next 3 years. City Council, as you know, also passed a bill to appoint an NYPD inspector general. When you add the police commissioner, that's a lot of people overseeing the police force. What will the inspector general and federal monitor be doing that's different from each other?
Well, the federal monitor, who will be in place 3 years, assuming that it's approved by the district court judge, He will monitor and to conduct compliance and progress reviews to assess the extent to which NYPD has implemented and complied with the reforms that are part of the order that has been signed by the judge. And the IG, an independent IG, will just monitor activities within NYPD pattern and practice to determine whether or not, in fact, they are, again, complying with the law and fostering trust within communities of color in the city of New York.
But again, when you talk about the monitor, what kinds of reforms? Because she's got to approve it probably in the next few weeks,
yeah.
Right? So is there going to be a submission to the court of an on-paper list of criteria that are different from the past that the police officers are going to use when deciding whether to stop and frisk somebody? Or what are the reforms that she would sign off at?
Well, I don't really know the mechanics, but I do know that in some of the recommended reforms that were put forth by Judge Shiland included, but were not limited to cameras, for instance, that some of the police officers could wear. And obviously, we are embracing technology more and more within NYPD.
That was the one that was in the news a lot. Police officers wearing lapel cameras, mm-hmm. and I think this was limited to the highest precinct for stop and frisk.
Correct.
In each borough, with the intent to be to record their encounters with the public. So you don't know if that's part of the settlement. This is something that the de Blasio administration now gets to include or not include on their proposed list, and the judge gets to sign off on
Correct.
It or not?
Correct. And cameras were one of the reforms that the judge had suggested, but it's not – it may not be one of the reforms that the two sides would agree upon. It all depends upon negotiations.
Do you favor the lapel camera proposal in particular? Some people have privacy concerns about police lapel cameras that would be facing out.
Yeah. There are some privacy concerns, and I question whether or not that's going to be part of the reforms moving forward. I do know that one of the reforms that possibly may be put on the table is obviously spelling out when and under what circumstances one can approach individuals and, in fact, stop and frisk them. There's also a suggestion with respect to advising individuals for the basis for the stop. There's another recommendation with regards to identification. So there's a number of recommendations that have been put forth, and again, it's subject to negotiation from both sides.
So it's a negotiation between the parties who were together on stage at the announcement yesterday, the plaintiff, Center for Constitutional Rights, ACLU, and on the other side, even though they agree on the general thrust of things, the mayor and
Correct.
His team. So there may yet be friction between those two sides on the details.
But there may be, but I'm not anticipating any friction. I'm hoping, obviously, we can move more towards community policing and have more police officers on the street and foster a better relationship, again, between communities of color and NYPD. That's really the objective moving forward.
New York City public advocate Letitia James with us. We'll go to your calls shortly at 212-433-WNYC. I know you wanted to comment on the federal food stamp cuts that have recently taken effect, and with more on the way, the food bank for New York City already reports shortages at food pantries and demand rising since the recent cuts to individuals. What can you do as public advocate?
So clearly, you know, the Office of Public Advocate is a bully pulpit to talk about issues, particularly issues related to income inequality and poverty in the city of New York. And when I was at the Speaker Melissa Mark Viverito's inauguration, there were four members of Congress there who I applauded, four members of Congress who voted against the cuts to food stamps. And we're looking at an $8.6 billion cut from the SNAP program. And most of the New York delegation, except one, the one who obviously has some anger issues, most of the New York delegation voted against it, but that one individual voted for it. And now,
New York, just to be clear to people who haven't seen New York One this week, where Staten Island Congressman Michael Grimm threatened a New York One reporter after a question that he didn't like, that you're talking about Michael Grimm, the Republican from Staten Island, as the exception, he's the one who supported the food stamp cuts.
Correct. And now that bill moves to the United States Senate, and I would urge everyone to reach out to our two United States senators, Senate representatives, and to urge them to vote against an $8.6 billion cut from the SNAP program. It would have a major adverse impact on children, single parents, the disabled, the homeless. Almost one in five New York residents, about 1.9 people, rely upon SNAP, and we need to do all that we can do to alleviate those who are living in poverty and not just make the conditions worse.
SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, a.k.a. food stamps. But defenders of the cuts say the food stamps program greatly expanded when the financial crisis hit, from $40 billion in 2008 to $85 billion by 2012, and peaking at more than 45 million Americans receiving benefits. So the argument is, maybe that was good and necessary in the crisis, but it's not 2009 anymore, and the idea was not a permanent increase of that size. What do you think?
So most of the city pantries and soup kitchens that I've spoke to have indicated, have seen a, witnessed an increase in a number of individuals who are relying upon those services. And as you know, back in November of last year, there was a cut, and we are seeing a 10% increase in individuals relying upon those services. And we also are witnessing a shortage in the supplies to food pantries and to soup kitchens. And so what we need now is more support, and we do not need to retreat from alleviating those individuals who unfortunately are living under the burden of or under the weight of poverty in the city of New York. And, you know, there is a tale of two cities, and that really was, I believe, a mandate in the city of New York that we need to do all that we can do to alleviate poverty. This bill really represents a regressive piece of legislation and is really short-sighted, and we are really harming the most vulnerable amongst us.
212-433-WNYC to talk to New York City Public Advocate Letitia James. And Lee in New York. Oops, Lee's not ready. Okay, we'll go first to Michael in Brooklyn Heights. Michael, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
We at Citizens Defending Libraries want to thank Tish very much for speaking out against the sale of public assets, schools, hospitals, public housing, parks, and particularly libraries, which she mentioned in her inaugural address and both her acceptance speeches when she won office.
All right. You told our screener you had a charter school question. Do you still have a charter school question?
I didn't talk to your screener.
Oh, okay. All right. So there's a shout out for your work on that score. David in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with a charter school question.
Yes. Good morning, and good morning, public advocate. You came and spoke to our school at Roy H. Mann and gave an amazing speech. Best entitled Separate and Unequal, with the co-locations of charter schools imposed on existing schools in the burg. And I understand that you're one of the people involved in the lawsuit and in getting that stopped. How's that going?
So first, let me just answer, give a shout out to Michael, who talked a little bit about the, you know, the public sale of the sale of public assets in the city of New York, public housing, public libraries, public hospitals moving going forward, and public playgrounds. And what we really need to do is reverse that trend and preserve all that which is public, and do all that we can to ensure that every New Yorker takes advantage of all of these precious assets, including our libraries. In regards to the charter school lawsuit, as you know, I filed a lawsuit myself and Speaker Melissa Vaca-Viverito. Basically, what we were trying to do is reverse the 11th hour ploy by then Mayor Bloomberg to institute co-locations at a number of schools, including Mann School in Brooklyn and others. And it was done without any sunshine, without any transparency, without the voice of parents, without the voice of stakeholders. And all that we are doing is reviewing all of those co-locations in the city of New York and in making sure that they are done in a deliberate fashion. The Blue Book, which is often used to calculate space allocations in school, is flawed. And the process by which we co-locate charter schools and public schools obviously needs to be revised and needs to be examined.
So, like Stop and Frisk, this is another example of using the courts to reverse what was a Bloomberg administration policy. But you're calling for a review, it sounds like, of the use of space in public schools and whether it's smart to put charter schools in some of those buildings and co-locate them with regular public schools. But what would the court order be?
So the court order right now, what we're doing is we filed a court order basically to stop the co-locations and to have the Department of Education examine each and every co-location in the city of New York. And so this
to stop them, to put a moratorium on all co-locations of public schools and charter schools.
Correct. To seek an injunction at this point in time so that the Department of Education can review co-locations, those co-locations that Mayor Bloomberg approved at the 11th hour prior to his exit from City Hall.
Let me ask you a follow-up question about one of the schools that would be involved in that, because I know our news department, our education reporters, have been looking into this possibility. And one of the schools that they reported on is Girls Prep in the Bronx, an elementary school that's supposed to expand to include a middle school next year as the girls move up. Today's fifth graders are guaranteed seats to continue. But my understanding is if your lawsuit succeeds, they may not have a school to go to next year. So what would you say to these low-income families with daughters in the Bronx who think your lawsuit is going to hurt their educations, according to the reporting that I heard?
What I would like in the city of New York is to raise all boats. What I would like is an educational system which produces quality education for all children and not just one particular sector. What I would like is for all children to have arts and culture and music and physical education. And unfortunately, a lot of those spaces have been compromised as a result of these co-locations. What I would like is for special needs children not to be taught in closets and in small classrooms. And what I would like for them is to have their PT and OT taught in their school. What I would like is a fair process of co-locating charter schools and public schools and to allow all voices to be heard. What I would like is a system which is not unequal and disparate.
All good and important. But to reach those goals, will you have to potentially harm some individuals along the way, like these families whose daughters go to Girls Prep in the Bronx?
The goal is not to harm anyone. The goal is to be open. The goal is to be fair. And the goal is to make sure that when we co-locate charter schools in public schools, that all voices are heard and that we're not harming any child.
I haven't heard if the de Blasio administration will defend the co-locations against your suit. What have they told you?
I've had a meeting with Chancellor Farina, who believes that we should really examine all of these co-locations. I've agreed at this point in time to adjourn the lawsuit until such time as she examines each and every co-location and reviews the Blue Book.
Oh, so that's news. The suit is adjourned, and you're in negotiations out of court with the school's chancellor.
I'm not really in negotiations. I'm waiting for her to do a full examination, and then upon completion of her examination, we will sit down at that point in time and negotiate.
Okay. Lee in New Rochelle, you're on WNYC with public advocate Letitia James. Hello.
Yes, hi. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I understand concerns about – my comment was about stop and frisk.
Sure.
I understand concerns about stop and frisk, but I think many of our modern issues are from a symptom of gun control, lax gun control, such as the Trayvon Martin shooting. Bloomberg's stop and frisk was probably a response to lax gun control. So my question is, getting rid of it, what will we do about more guns on the street? Do you think that's what we will have?
Lee, thank you. And that's certainly the way the Bloomberg administration portrayed Stop and Frisk. It was an anti-gun program.
It was portrayed as an anti-gun program. However, it wasn't very effective at confiscating guns. And the reality is that most of the stops and frisks did not yield enough guns to justify the program. And you cannot justify the ends by means that violated the rights of individuals in the city of New York. And I supported the mayor and continue to support the mayor with respect to all that he has done on gun control in this nation. However, again, it did not yield a sufficient number of guns to justify the program, and the vast majority of the individuals who were stopped and frisked had done absolutely nothing wrong, and it was premised on this notion that everyone who was being stopped and frisked was a criminal.
And the stat, I think, is 1/10 of 1% of the stops yielded illegal guns?
Correct.
So what if, though, hypothetically, if I can ask you a what-if question, what if shootings go up this year now that stop and frisk, the way it was practiced, is being cut back? And maybe it won't, there, because last year crime went down as stop and frisks were going down. What if it were to go up? What would you want the police to do?
Well, I don't like to deal in hypotheticals, but let me play along. So I think what we really should do is hire more police. What we should do is more community policing. What we should do is foster a better relationship with the community. You know, as someone who is very grassroots and who speaks to individuals, I know countless number of individuals and communities who know who the bad people are and know where they live and know the types of illegal conduct they engage in. If only we can foster some sort of trust with communities, individuals would not feel would not be fearful to move to cooperate with NYPD and work with them collaboratively to address a spike in crime. And that's what the criminal justice system is based on, our relationship with the community. And unfortunately, that relationship has been broken.
David in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Letitia James. Hello. David, you there? All right. No, David. Let's try Cassius in Brooklyn. Hi, Cassius.
Hey, Brian. I'd really like the public advocate to address this problem of all of us bicyclists here in the city receiving the same tickets from cops that they give out to car drivers, so that, you know, we get these outrageously high-priced tickets. You know, like if I roll up to a red light and it's late at night, there's hardly any traffic, and I stop and I make sure it's safe, and then I go through, you know, I can get like a $190 ticket. You know, we're not car drivers and we're not pedestrians. We're somewhere in between, and we just do not deserve to be ticketed with such outrageously high priced tickets. It has to be a change. It's really ridiculous. I mean,
and we're hearing this a lot, Cassius. I'm going to get a response for you. We certainly are hearing this complaint from any number of bicyclists. Do you have a position?
Yeah, you know, obviously I am committed to street safety in the city of New York. In my district, my former district, Fort Greene, Clinton Hill, Prospect Heights, and Crown Heights, we had a significant number of fatalities with individuals, both pedestrian fatalities and bicycle fatalities. And I've heard from a number of cyclists with regards to this abuse. Abusive practice of NYPD focusing on cyclists, and obviously it's an issue that I really want to focus on. As soon as the budget of the public advocate is restored, I hope to hire a deputy public advocate who can focus on street safety as well as this alleged practice.
All right. We just have a few minutes left. Let me see if we can go through a few other things real quick. You attended the recent rally for Interfaith Hospital.
Yes.
When they had temporarily stopped accepting ambulances. But the de Blasio administration did not have anyone at that rally, and you called on him to spend $3 million in city funds as a stopgap for this Crown Heights Hospital. Do you fear that he's wavering at all on what was one of his central issues in the campaign?
I was calling upon Governor Cuomo, who was basically holding hostage $3 million that had been negotiated by some elected officials in central Brooklyn to keep Interfaith Hospital open. What I was calling for is the mayor of the city of New York to put forth an initiative, as he had suggested during the campaign, this healthcare network in the borough of Brooklyn and beyond, want to preserve hospitals as we know it, to preserve Litch, Long Island College Hospital, Interfaith, and other hospitals that unfortunately are facing a number of challenges.
So did the city come up with that money, or did you get it some other way? I know that there was a temporary infusion, I think, from the state, and now you're waiting for something more permanent from the federal government, but my understanding is the feds have said no to the request.
Well, we received some stopgap money from the governor, as was originally promised. We were successful in getting those funds from Governor Cuomo, and we thank him for that. There is a federal waiver, which is currently being negotiated, and we have received indications that, in fact, the federal waiver will be approved. There has been some communication protection from the federal government, the federal waiver monies, Medicaid monies, cannot be used to keep open these failing hospitals. And we're negotiating with the Cuomo administration as well as with the federal government.
Meaning the money might come, but it can't be directly applied to keep opening the failing hospitals?
That was articulated in a letter that we received from Secretary Sebelius. And so we're urging United States Senator Schumer as well as Gillibrand to negotiate on our behalf and to change the position of the federal government. So, in fact, those dollars can be used to keep these hospitals open.
Oh, that's really interesting. All right. Briefly, we talked about the Inspector General and Federal Monitor for the NYPD. Let me ask you about another piece of oversight. City Council this week asked some very tough questions to the mayor's appointee for Department of Investigations chief, because he was from the de Blasio campaign. And the job is to oversee the agencies of the city that the mayor presides over. So as an independent public advocate, are you disappointed that the person supposed to be the watchdog over mayoral agencies is a mayoral campaign pal?
No. I'm sort of biased. I know the appointee. I used to work with the appointee in the office of the New York State Attorney General's office, and I believe that he will be a fine and independent inspector general in the city of New York.
And last thing, Chinese New Year. Do you support the calls to make it a school holiday, along with the Hindu holiday of Diwali and the two big Muslim holiday Eids?
Yes, I do.
And I guess we end it there. Anything else you want to say? Open mic for the last minute?
No, just let me just say, again, a shout out to Dasani. You know, obviously, the plight of homelessness in our city is still a major issue, and there are thousands of Dasanis out there, and we need to do all that we can do to address homelessness in the city of New York. I look forward to working with the mayor of the city of New York to build more affordable housing and to incorporate homeless families.
The Dasani, the girl who was profiled in that New York Times series, who you had with you at your inauguration on January 1st. Anything new from Dasani? Do you know?
Well, we've been talking to her family. We're trying to assist her family. But more important than that, we're trying to staff up in the Office of Public Advocate to assist all Dasani families, all homeless families in the city of New York, providing them direct services, having volunteer attorneys and individuals to do casework.
And I hope you'll come back and talk more about that as a specific separate topic on another occasion.
Thank you very much, Brian.
New York City Public Advocate Letitia James coming up next this week in Bridgegate. Matt Katz from New Jersey Public Radio and WNYC's Andrea Bernstein review the progress of the official investigations and of their own investigative reporting. Stay with us.